Hello all, and the very warmest of welcomes to the True Crime Enthusiast podcast, coming to you from a North Wales that seems to be on the cusp of summer this week, although in the brief periods alongside the incessant rain, and from where each time around I bring you not your run-of-the-mill regurgitated tale of the same old 50 or 60 true crime cases that so many shows think that's all there is, but rather, the often unfamiliar and perhaps long-forgotten tales from the shores of the UK and Ireland. Doing so is myself, Paul, the creator, host and true crime enthusiast of the show's title. The main man, my beloved true crime enthusiast cat, Peaksy, is here with me also. And we're completed by yourselves, the enthusiasts that this is all for and is all thanks to. It is as fabulous as always having you join us today. I thank you kindly for doing so. And I do hope that as you have done, then it's for a tale that finds you and yours all good, all safe, and all well. We shall be on with the tale I've selected this time around shortly, but first off, massive thanks must go out to both the new and returning Patreon supporters of the show, with shout-outs here going out to Karen Boatman, Sue, John Lloyd, Sandy, First Neil, Last Eddie, Rhiannon Malik, Zoe, Michael Webb, Jay, Terry, Dipali Dahlia, Claire Bragg, Colin Carruthers, Kate Munden, Joe Westwood, Joni Bear, Cheryl and Fiona Young, plus Jess, Lisa Jones, Demi Marsh, Emma Jane and Erin M. Baker, who have opted to annually support the show. What can I say, folks? It is so very kind of you to do so, and you have my utmost thanks. Each of you rule. Now, if like these legends I've just mentioned, you fancy a little bit of extra enthusiast in your life, then for 4 groats and a ferret's egg, you can have yourself access to more than 50 bonus right mixed bag of unreleased tales from the enthusiast, from tales of pure horror such as Behind Closed Doors, or the latest tale that's out, Copycat, to random and bizarre tales such as The Strange Tale of Hellish Nell and The Mystery of Leatham Street, or those that are a bit more light-hearted, such as Are You Sure You're Legal? And The Master Criminals. There's something to tickle almost every earbud, with a new one released mostly at the end of each month. Doing so is a doddle to do as well. Just head over to Patreon and seek out the True Crime Enthusiast podcast on there. Remember that podcast suffix, or you may not find it. Or you don't even need to worry about that, because in the section of every episode show notes, there is a link to the show's Patreon that will take you right to it. And you can be hearing these mentioned tales and many more quicker than O.J. Simpson thinking to himself, "Fucking hell, it's a bit hot down here." Johnny Cochran isn't getting you out of that one, Juice, you murdering bastard. Now, our tale this time around is another case of me changing the running order of episodes. What happens often is that I research as much as I can, I come to do it, and then I find other research materials that I can use, but I have to order in. And it's as thorough as I can be, or it's not at all. So I put them off until I can do just that, and the tales in question will come very soon. This substitute tale, however, is one I have gone as far as I can with. And for it, I've had a reach into the show's back catalogue from the Patreon files. Now, there are particular types of crimes that get to me more than others. Anything concerning children or the elderly particularly anger and sicken me, as they're committed against two of the most vulnerable cross-sections of our society. But another that does is those crimes that are committed against those who are classed as vulnerable, those with a physical inability or with learning difficulties. One of the most disturbing and tragic episodes I've ever brought through the past 8 series of the show is an episode some years ago entitled With Friends Like These, where we heard the tragic stories of Michael Gilbert and Gemma Hayter, two vulnerable adults who were both betrayed in the most horrific of manners by so-called individuals that they classed as friends. And in the next couple of episodes of The Enthusiast, I will be bringing a couple of similar tales of just how cruel and vile people, and I mean that in the loosest term describing the perpetrators here, can be. The tale selected this time is one that describes such people, and In fact, they became very fitting for this series' Monsters Of episode. It is a tale that horrified me when I brought it to Patreon a couple of years ago now, as I'm sure it will you too. The episode contains details and descriptions of crimes and events involving an elderly person that some listeners may find disturbing and or distressing, so please use discretion whilst listening in all. Bearing that in mind, please join the true crime enthusiasts for this series' Monsters Of episode, Monsters of Greater Manchester. For our tale, we're off to pastures we visited before, the borough of Oldham in Greater Manchester, this time to its town of Failsworth. Notable about Failsworth is that it's reportedly a centre for hat making, and notable people to hail from there include supermodel Agnes Dean, former Manchester United midfielder Ronnie Walwork, cricketer Mike Atherton, the musical acts Pure Essence and Entrance, and legendary bassist from the Stone Roses and later Primal Scream, Manny himself, the Rogue Rose. It's here in Failsworth that in September 1998, one of the most senseless and callous crimes there is imaginable took place. A crime in which two children crossed the line from delinquency to full-blown criminality. Both were girls, both were under 16 years of age at the time of the crime, and the names were not made public at the time proceedings came to court, or following them, because the courts had decided, against a ruling from the presiding judge, I must add, that they should continue to be referred to as Child A and Child B. It was a ruling that was roundly condemned at the time and was rightfully overturned in November 2002 by the Lord Chief Justice, Lord Wolfe. You'll see why exactly it was condemned in the account that follows. Lillian Lilly, who we shall call Lily for our tale, was a well-known figure in the Failsworth area, as she was perceived as an eccentric, shall we say, by those who knew her. She'd lived most of her life in the same semi-detached house, number 17 West Street, though for more than a decade, the amount of time does vary through different reports, by herself, following the death of her husband Jack. The couple's only son John, a mechanic, had emigrated to Tasmania in the early 1970s, so following Jack's death, Lily led a somewhat lonely and solitary existence. She was generally well-liked, although she may have unwillingly and unfairly invited a certain amount of derision towards herself due to a habit of muttering to herself, and the fact that whatever the weather, rain, snow, sun or heatwave, she would always wear a bright, shiny red raincoat buttoned right up to the neck. A neighbour of Lily's for more than a quarter of a century, Mary Hale, later described her to the Manchester Evening News, saying, "When we came here, she was already here, with her husband Jack, working at the Ferranti electronics factory in Hollinwood, which closed years ago. She went a bit strange over the years. She was very thin and quite smart, but wore odd things, like shiny Macs with a hood up when everybody else was wearing t-shirts because it was so warm. She would talk to herself a lot, and sometimes you would hear her shouting, ranting and raving in the back garden, and think that she was having a massive row with someone, when she was actually on her own. But she never caused any problems. At one time, there were a lot of cats. I think she had 16 before the RSPCA took all but two away. I never saw any friends or visitors there. I think she had a son in Australia, but she hadn't spoken to him for years. I feel sick to think that something could have been going on in that house, and we could have helped her. But then nobody had much contact with her. And that was the way she liked it." Mary went on to add that many elderly people in the West Road area at the time had problems with gangs of children, saying, "They come from all round and hang about in gangs. Lily was tormented. They'd congregate in front of her house and use the drive as a goal. She used to give them lemonade and crisps, but because she was a bit odd, they took upon this. They'd bang on the door to ask for money or sweets, break the windows, and take the mickey. It'd been going on a long time. I used to go round and ask if she was okay, and if she wanted me to do anything about them. Now, there do seem to be conflicting opinions about Lily's relationship with the local children. Another former neighbour, Robert Kershaw, said later of Lily, "She was a bit odd, but never did anyone any harm. She was easy to get on with, and most of the children liked her. She would try to befriend them, and most of them would do jobs for her. It was just a few who would cause her trouble, especially those two." Neighbour Linda Taggart, who also lived nearby to Lily, recalled chasing off kids on several occasions, saying, "Contrary to the media reports that Lily took in young kids, she was plagued by them. They hammered on her door, threw stones through her windows and shouted at her, even in the house. She only gave them money and food to stop the bullying." Whatever the relationship Lily had with the local children was, it's correct, even if it sounds unfair, to say that Lily was thought of as somewhat of an oddity in the neighbourhood, perhaps cruelly referred to as the mad old lady in the red mac. And even if she had befriended some of the local children, it's highly likely that such a familiar figure, with her reported characteristics, would become a target of torment from at least some of them. Kids can be evil little shytalks after all, can't they? And I'm sure that when you were a youngster, and I was certainly never a saint when I was, I must admit, but I'm sure that there must have been a certain someone, a well-known figure in your area that you may have teased, given cheek to, played knock and run on their door or hedge-hopped through their garden, that kind of thing. Someone who would react to it, who would come out and remonstrate, sometimes even chase you off, which would only really succeed in making you do it all the more because you get that reaction. It's all a bit of a laugh in front of your mates at the time, isn't it? And it makes you look super cool. Except when you become an adult and you realise that, no, it isn't a laugh, and all it really makes you look like is a little twat that needs a good hiding. Back then in September 1998, two of the local youths that undoubtedly knew Lily and the two that Robert Kershaw had hinted at were 14-year-old Sarah Davey and her slightly older 15-year-old friend, Lisa Healy. I won't entertain any of this child A or B bollocks whatsoever, and I'll refer to these two mainly by surname from here on in. The older of the two girls, Healy, was described later in court by one defence psychiatrist as to be suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder following a campaign of terror that had been waged against her family, beginning 3 years before the crime in 1995, when she was living with her family in the Longsight area of Manchester. Healy's mother Margaret had witnessed a post office robbery, and after the statement she'd provided to police was used in the subsequent prosecution of the offenders, retribution for grassing was swiftly forthcoming. Margaret was beaten up and slashed, Healy's brother had been stabbed, and her father beaten with a baseball bat in front of the then 11-year-old girl. She too had suffered at school, finding herself bullied and ostracised to the point where she moved schools some 4 times in an attempt to curb the problem. It led to the young girl somewhat going off the rails a bit. She became aggressive and an accomplished liar. She began to truant regularly, drinking, smoking, using drugs and the like. She ran away from home more than once and, fully aware of the dangers that came with it, became sexually active and began accepting lifts from strangers. Soon, shoplifting, vandalism, and even a fray were added to her traits, and by 1997, aged just 13, she'd been cautioned by police no less than 5 times. Sarah Davey, meanwhile, came across a bit more of the good girl gone wrong stereotype than her slightly older partner in crime. Her mother, Deborah Davey, was to blame the events of the summer of 1998 solely at the feet of her daughter's friend. She was to claim that Sarah was well behaved until she met Healy, and that Healy had gained some sort of hold over Sarah, corrupting her. This is despite the fact that Sarah, who although was considered a capable student at school, was considered equally to be somewhat mouthy, quick with the lip, and having a reputation for answering back, as well as a bit of a bully, one who'd been punished on numerous occasions for fighting. She'd also been arrested once before for shoplifting, having stolen some bread for a day, she claimed, although no serious punishment was forthcoming as a result of this. So, in 1998, as both girls attended the same school, Failsworth's Co-op Academy, Lisa having moved to attend there at the time, they became friends, with a slightly older girl taking somewhat of a shine to the younger. Before long, such was the partnership they'd forged that other youngsters recognised that it was one best avoided. In Lisa, Sarah saw someone who would show her a fast way to independence and freedom, whereas Lisa saw a perfect partner in crime, and wanting to break away from adult control became their focus, trying to appear big and streetwise. They did this not with mature behaviour and common sense, but with a run of vandalism, petty thefts, casual sex and antisocial behaviour, all the while talking between them of this fantasy they had, where they had a home of their own, where no parental constraint could be exercised. But behaving like this doesn't come without the inevitable brush with the law, and at the beginning of September 1998, the two were caught shoplifting in the company of Healy's younger cousin, who they reportedly were using as a decoy. The following day, both were again stopped by police, this time carrying with them a pair of rice flails, which led to a caution for one and consideration whether to charge the other with possession of an offensive weapon, when the two then promptly absconded from home. They spent some time wandering the streets, although remained in the Failsworth area, and although both were reported as missing by their parents, they weren't seen by family of either until the evening of Wednesday the 23rd of September 1998, when they arrived at the Oldham home of Davy's grandfather and asked him if they could stay the night there. Although he agreed, the two girls did not stay at the house longer than for a few hours, for at about 5 a.m. on the Thursday morning, the pair, both drunk out of their minds, were picked up by a truck driver they'd flagged down on a nearby main road. Both girls claimed to the driver to be 16 years of age, with one saying that she was pregnant, and for some reason, perhaps to elicit sympathy, they both said that they were in the care system. The driver reportedly took both of them with him to the North Wales area, where he was due to deliver, before returning to Oldham and leaving them back in Failsworth at about 10 a.m. that Wednesday morning. Now, perhaps Davy's grandfather wouldn't have been so willing to accommodate them, well, certainly Davy's new friend Healy anyway, had he known what was said before the girls had left his house in the early hours. Although these did transpire to be just words, at this time anyway. The older Healy had reportedly asked Davy if her grandfather lived alone. When she told her that he did, Healy had said to Davy, "Should I kill him and then we can have his house?" Kid you not, yes. Kind of chilling that, eh? Whether it was meant then or was even believed by the younger girl isn't sure, but it wasn't acted upon. But it was later that Thursday morning that they spotted the familiar, unmistakable figure of Lillian Lilly outside the health centre in Failsworth, only a few hundred yards from her home, number 17 West Street. As I said before, it's likely, very likely, especially because Davy lived nearby to her, that Davy and Healy were two such children who enjoyed tormenting Lily. What is established is that they certainly knew her. And when they spotted Lily carrying some filled shopping bags crossing the street by the health centre, just off where the Tesco Extra Superstore stands today, they decided to approach her, to torment her for a laugh. Ignoring her indignant protests when they reached her, the two immediately started looking through her shopping bags, and while Lily protested, she was sworn at to prove how tough they really were, and the offer of carrying her shopping home for her was made. Although Lily said politely, though in a somewhat trembling voice, that she could manage, the two picked up on this apprehension and began to follow her, taking delight in Lily's habit of muttering to herself and constantly mocking her for it as they followed her. They could tell that the old lady was trying to hurry home without making it too obvious, and they kept this up all the way back to number 17. Now, whether they bullied their way into the house, or whether Lily, perhaps fearful and hoping to placate the two, accepted the request that one of them possibly made of wanting a drink or wanting to use the toilet is unsure. It can be ascertained, however, that the older of the two girls, as was described by a witness to this who later testified in court, then took a bottle of shampoo from Lily's bag of shopping and squirted it at her, hitting her in the face and eyes with it. Either way, following this, the two girls were admitted into the house, and although Lily told them to stay in the kitchen while she put the kettle on, desperate to get rid of them, both ignored this and went into the front room where they both began searching it. They tormented Lily when she came in after them and attempted to snatch back from one of the girls a handful of papers and photographs that they'd removed from a sideboard drawer, inviting her to chase them around the room to get them, all the while growing more confident. Because they knew by then, seeing the fear and discomfort in the old lady's eyes, that had she had the means to contact someone outside to come and help her, surely she would have done it by then. Now, there are some discrepancies about the order of events that followed here, but what can be ascertained is that from that Thursday onwards, the two pretty much had the full run of number 17 West Street, the home Lily had lived in for almost 50 years, and of Lily, there was no sign. That Thursday afternoon, Healy was seen running out of the house, and Lily could be heard shouting, "Go on, get out!" Though this was quite a regular occurrence really, as Lily would often remonstrate with one or more of her cats, and so no attention would be given to an utterance like this. But Healy did not seem concerned, and instead made her way back inside and shut the door behind her. A neighbour of Lily's, knocking on the door some time later, got no answer, and when he looked through the letterbox, saw one of the girls duck down behind the sofa. But by the next day, the Friday, both girls were quite brazen about being in the house. One neighbour saw Healy in the backyard of the house that afternoon, and reportedly, they told several people that they saw passing that they were Lily's grandchildren, even again trotting out the story about being pregnant. One caller, a young neighbour who had called around to see where Mrs. Lily was even told by Healy, leaning out of an upstairs window, "She's nutty. I'm going to have to kill her, I think." I wish that I could tell you this was a bluff, or that these were just idle boasts or shows of bravado, but sadly, I can't. There are conflicting reports in the statements of both Healy and Davy that were heard at the trial, and while the testimony of either cannot be relied upon as gospel, from that Thursday afternoon, as best as can be ascertained through research, the following account took place. One of the girls, most likely Healy, told Lily that she was going to use the toilet upstairs, which to Lily meant that one or the other of the pair would have to be left unsupervised long enough to be able to steal something. Healy went upstairs unattended, and when she hadn't come down some time later, Lily became even more agitated, certain that she was up to no good. She didn't really want to leave Davy alone in the living room, but needed to see what Healy was doing, and so headed upstairs. Shortly afterwards, there was the sound of a scuffle, and although the immaturity of Davy may have led to her contemplating running away, she instead decided to head upstairs to see what was going on. Getting to the top of the stairs, she called for her friend, who then appeared from one of the bedrooms and beckoned for her to come in. 71-year-old Lily was lying on the floor, rasping for breath, moaning softly and scarcely conscious. The older of the two girls smiled at the younger one and said, "She's not dead," all the while pocketing jewellery and knick-knacks from an open drawer of Lily's bedside dresser. Then she said that rather than flee, as the gravity of the situation would have most likely made most people do by that time, they should tie her up and, I quote, "stay here for a bit. that was the wording used. Seeing the reluctance on the younger girl's face, Healy told Davy as a reminder that they'd always wanted their own house to do what they want in, and the opportunity for that is now right there, one that she certainly wasn't going to let pass her by. "If you're too chicken to stay, you can fuck off back home," were the words that swayed Davy and sealed Lily Lily's fate. Both girls then went back downstairs, and remembering catching a glimpse of Lily hiding her purse in a kitchen drawer, headed right for it. Once they discovered the purse, the few pounds that were inside, the remnants of Lily's weekly pension money, were shared equally between the two, and then the drawer was shut. But not before one of them, it isn't clear which, had taken a blunt table knife out of the drawer as well. Heading back upstairs, they found Lily still on the bedroom floor where they'd left her, when suddenly she stirred and her eyes half opened. Reacting immediately to this, one of the girls, and it really doesn't matter which one it was, it can't be ascertained, and they took the following in turns anyway. One of the girls grabbed a pillow from the bed, and sitting on the old lady's chest, forced it over Lily's face, causing her to kick and struggle in the panic that must come with something like that, whilst the other jabbed and slashed at her exposed legs and right arm with the table knife, the pillow muffling the resulting cries. They took it in turns to do each of these horrific actions in tandem until, when they'd tired of doing this, they removed the pillow to discover that the old lady was still breathing, albeit shallowly and very laboured. Each account given then claims that they came up with the idea of gagging and binding Mrs. Lily and leaving her trussed up in the bedroom. Searching, they found a bandage in one of the bedroom drawers and, propping Lily up into a sitting position, forced it into her mouth, one of them holding it tightly in place whilst the other fastened it in a secure knot behind Lily's head. So tightly was the bandage forced into her mouth, however, that Lily's dentures were displaced and forced back into her throat, causing her to choke. The panic of choking brought the badly injured old lady briefly back to consciousness, as it does when you choke on something. I'm sure you know the panicking sensation I mean. But neither girl's response was to assist her to claw the bandage from her mouth and remove the obstruction, nothing like that. Instead, one of the girls immediately placed the pillow over her face once again, and when it was finally taken off, Lily had stopped struggling and stopped choking. Because she died. Now, when I read up on this case and when it was told to someone before I came to write the episode, their reaction to it was the same as mine. I was lost for words, absolutely appalled and speechless at such horror. It's the only possible word that I could use. I take no pleasure in describing events such as these in detail, but we always go all in here, of course, don't we? And as with any tale here on The Enthusiast, I want to portray the true evil of such actions to you, which I've done by describing the foul events that led to the death of Lily Lily. I want you to feel exactly how I felt. And I wish I could tell you that was the end of the old lady's suffering, but even in death, she wasn't allowed any dignity, which we shall get to shortly. Allegedly, Healy said, after killing Lily, "Let's see what's here, we might as well take what's going," before adding, "We can have a house, we can live in this house." She then warned her younger friend, "I'm going to seriously fucking damage you if you say anything." And then, perhaps to try and lighten the mood developing between the two, yes, this is how the pair were thinking, even reportedly said, jokingly, "Lily, don't come and haunt me." There are no words, are there? Wicked beyond belief. Once Mrs. Lily had been murdered, it would seem that both of the girls pushed any conscience that they might have had to the back of their minds and began having a good time in their new house. They set off to the shops across the road, where they bought, amongst other things, deodorant, toothpaste and toothbrushes, chocolate, crisps, a box of Cocoa Pops, and an amount of cannabis from an acquaintance that they met outside, all with a few pounds taken from Lily's purse. According to the account of Davy, the two girls then crossed the main Ashton Road West and went for a short walk down by the Rochdale Canal. And it was here that Healy came up with an idea about how they might get rid of Lily's body. That evening, back at the house in West Street, Healy came into the living room pulling a wheelie bin that had been stationed outside Lily's house, the one provided by local councils for removal of household waste. Although it was half full of refuse, she tipped it onto its side on the living room floor and told Davy that it was time for them to get rid of the body. Between the pair, they wrapped Lily's body in a blanket and pulled her downstairs. Then, a quote from Davy's later account, kicked and pushed her corpse into it, only managing to do so with a slight old lady who'd weighed just 8 stones, bent double inside the bin. After placing it upright, for reasons unknown to anyone except the murderous pair, they then placed in after her various documents, including a framed photograph of Lily's son John as a baby and a birth certificate, before shutting the lid and pulling the bin outside through the front door. Where they were heading, they'd already decided earlier that day. The pair were seen by several people as they made their way through the streets of Failsworth, giggling together, this perhaps being a nervous reaction, or perhaps horrifically, because they were enjoying the whole affair. And one witness that passed them recalled later one of them saying, "I can't believe we're doing this," to which the other had replied, "Yeah, whatever." The exact route taken cannot be established, for reports conflict as to the way they went. Some claim that their route took them out of West Street and across Ashton Road West, towards the health centre where they'd earlier that day first intercepted their victim, then onto the Oldham Road. I know the topography of the area will have changed somewhat in 24 years, but when I looked up on Google Maps, a much more likely route to have taken would have been out of West Street, past the Mare and Foale pub and across Ashton Road West, where almost immediately opposite the pub is a business premises car park with a footpath running alongside it. Whichever way they went is largely immaterial, however, for although many witnesses saw them, no one sought to ask them what they were doing or where they were off to. Reportedly, a bouncer at the pub recalled seeing the two struggling down some stone steps with a bin, and although he made some comment about the bin and its weight, and indeed he must have had some idea about where it was going to likely end up from the direction they were heading in, made no effort to intervene. In fact, if he had had an idea, his suspicions were all but confirmed when he saw the two girls again about 30 minutes later, this time minus the wheelie bin. The final destination was never in any doubt. Although it is today a lot more regularly and better kept, back in 1998, the section of the Rochdale Canal that runs through Failsworth was a rat-infested nightmare, for years being nothing but a dumping ground for rubbish of all kinds. Only some 3 feet deep, it was cluttered with debris, and it was here that the pair had decided would be the final resting place of Lily Lily. Pushing the bin in, they watched, pretty much not caring, as it hit the bottom, but only partly submerging, because they'd neglected to weight the bin down to ensure that it would sink. Still, they thought, it wouldn't be noticed. It was hardly discernible amongst the other rubbish that littered the canal, after all, and both made their way back to West Street without even a glance back. Now, of all the ways that there are to dispose of a body, this has to rank up there with the most callous and disrespectful there can be, doesn't it? What I've already described to you is surely bad enough, but this is just that extra level of foul, isn't it? The events that followed over the next 2.5 days again cannot be ascertained in any kind of order, but as I said earlier in the episode, Healy and Davy went about trashing Lily's home, treating it like their own. At some point over this period, they went back to the same stretch of canal and threw a bin bag, it filled with Lily's clothes and belongings, into the canal before returning to number 17 and continuing wrecking havoc there. They graffitied on the walls and furniture, scrawling and gouging their names and childish musings and obscenities onto them. On one wall in the living room, in paint, they had even daubed the word kill. The whole house was ransacked and left in disarray. The kitchen drawers were emptied all over the floor and the room flooded. Every light in the property was left on, although sheets had been hung over the windows, perhaps to prevent passers-by from seeing anything was up. There were cigarettes put out on the floor everywhere, empty solvents that had been abused littered around, and in a relatively short time, the once tidy home was left like a squat. Over the 2.5 days, the two girls had even used Lily's telephone to make some 258 calls. Unreal, eh? Far from laying low, as I said before, most people would do having committed such horror, the two girls seemingly had no kind of precautions about discovery taken and simply partied their way through the next few days. Aside from meeting up with men in a nearby pub, on at least 2 occasions before the Sunday after they'd killed Lily, the two girls also invited teenage boys into the house for sex. And when one of these asked where the occupant, the old lady, was, he was told, "We've killed her." Whichever one had said this quickly said that she was only joking, but added, "But I wouldn't go fishing if I were you," to which both girls started laughing at before the other said that they shouldn't, I quote, "make what we've done so obvious." But by the Sunday, as children do, the pair had a falling out. It would seem from later accounts that there was a heated debate about something, perhaps them disagreeing about what to do next, knowing that their actions could not remain undiscovered indefinitely. Perhaps the cold light of day of what they'd done had dawned on them, and they'd sobered up quicker than Phil Mitchell can do, because he can sober up like on the snap of bloody fingers like that, can't he? Or perhaps they were simply just getting on each other's wick after being together for so long. But by that Sunday there was a furious row which left Davy wearing only her underwear and having to demand all of her clothes back from Healy, which spelled the beginning of the end for the pair, as this row caused Davy to decide to head back home to her mother, but with a plan. Knowing that it would only be a matter of time before they were caught, her idea was to go home and confess the whole horrific story to her mother, but to put the whole blame onto Healy. When she came home and told her mother the story that Sunday afternoon, so horrified was Deborah Davy that she vomited. She then did the decent thing and contacted police. Right around the same time that Deborah Davy was attempting coming to terms with the horror story her daughter had come out with, a next-door neighbour of Lily's, Paul Shaw, had also raised the alarm to police following concerns that he had for Lily. He said later, "Some kids knocked and said that Lily's back door had been kicked open. I had a look and then called the police. When they arrived, I went in with them, but she was nowhere to be seen." The house was found as I described previously. It was only shortly afterwards, as police were beginning to search for the missing occupant of number 17, that Deborah Davy went to police with a scarcely believable tale, leading to the arrests later that afternoon of 14-year-old Sarah Davy and 15-year-old Lisa Healy on suspicion of murder. Later again that same afternoon, following the information received from Deborah, police divers recovered from the rubbish-strewn section of the Rochdale Canal the body of tragic Lily, where she'd been dumped unceremoniously. The later post-mortem revealed that she'd been suffocated. Both Healy and Davy were questioned by detectives over a 72-hour period, each blaming the other, and on Wednesday the 30th of September 1998 were charged with the murder of 71-year-old Lily Lilly. They appeared the same day at a youth court held in Oldham and were remanded in custody awaiting trial. Reportedly, and I found this an especially tragic part of the tale, Lily's son John had not seen his mother in several years, and it is unclear how often, if ever, that they even spoke on the telephone. So out of touch was he with her that it was reported that police were attempting to find him to notify him of his mother's death, and he was not made aware until his own son read of the murder some days later at his home in the Australian city of Launceston, when details of the crime had filtered over to the Australian press. John Lilly said later, "I was absolutely shocked. I can't believe someone would do this to my poor old mum. She wouldn't hurt a fly. My mum lived a typical pensioner life with not a lot of excitement. She worried about making sure the milkman was paid, general things like that. She was from a hard-working background. She supported the house when my father was crippled with rheumatoid arthritis and would get up at the crack of dawn to go to work." He went on, "I'm the only child, you see. It makes it really hard. I don't really quite know what these people have done. I've always thought it was bad enough to lose someone you love, but to have someone take their life away and leave their family with a horrible feeling of loss, I can't even explain to you what I'm feeling. My ambition in life was going to see my mum again. It was something I planned for, but of course, it's easier said than done. I just feel bloody awful." Reportedly, John Lilly was also, I quote, "hoping to come to England as soon as possible." Now, I know people's circumstances may be different, but if it was my mum we were talking about, there'd be no hoping and no as soon as I'd be there. The impression I was left with overall, and perhaps I'm speaking somewhat out of turn here, was that when John had emigrated in 1971, that new life he sought was easier to do if he left his old one behind completely, including his mum. I thought that she seemed a bit of an afterthought to him, someone to only speak to periodically, and that saddened me, for I know and love just how close me and my own mum are. I don't know if that's the case, of course, with John and Lily. It's just what I thought. But I digress. The trial of Sarah Davy and Lisa Healy, or Child A and Child B as they were known due to reporting restrictions imposed, for the murder of Lily Lilly began at Manchester Crown Court in July 1999, where they each pleaded not guilty. A first of its kind trial also, as following criticism of the UK legal system by the European Court of Human Rights over the conduct of the Bulger trial a few years previously, which undoubtedly needs no introduction whatsoever, does it? Specifically cases involving minors, proceedings were adapted to make both girls feel more comfortable in the court setting. The entire 6-week trial was conducted without any of the court staff, from barristers up to the presiding Mr. Justice Sachs, wearing the traditional wigs and robes so commonly seen. Both defendants sat throughout proceedings in the seats of the court usually occupied by barristers, instead of in the dock, and all court sitting times of proceedings each day were cut and held to coincide with the times that both girls would normally attend school. Yes, you have heard me right there. Manchester Crown Court heard that the girls, both only 15 and 14 at the time, had become close friends at the start of the previous year's summer holidays. They'd met and taken advantage of the eccentric Lily, after being invited, for want of a better word, into a house in September of the previous year for a cup of tea, but the prosecution's case being that they actually intended to take over her house and to use it to entertain men. The court then heard the horrific details leading up to the murder of Lily, as you've heard described here, from the statements of both Healy and Davy, who each blamed the other for the crime. Richard Enriquez QC for the prosecution told the court, Having killed Mrs. Lily, the prosecution's case is that these two girls forced her body into a wheelie bin and pushed it into the Rochdale Canal. As we have heard, the court was told that both girls then made Mrs. Lily's house their own, Healy spending the time they were there sleeping in Lily's bed, whilst David stayed downstairs. The court heard all I've explained, even how they used the telephone some 258 times in a 70-hour period. Whenever they were seen, the older girl passed herself off as Lily's granddaughter, and they also told local children the house was now theirs and had several lads around, presumably for sex. Dr. William Lawler, the pathologist who had examined Tragic Lily, appeared and gave evidence to the court about the injuries found to her body, the knife marks and superficial cuts to her lower legs and right arm, as well as bruising to the head, consistent, he said, with her having been punched and kicked. Cause of death had been deemed suffocation due to Lily choking on her own false teeth, with him describing how they'd been violently forced to the back of her throat due to the tight gag, and how she would have coughed and spluttered for several minutes before the dentures and her tongue blocked her airway completely. Imagine how the jury must have felt hearing that. Horrendous even thinking about it, isn't it? And yet it must have been hard for the jury to even comprehend that these girls were even capable of such things, so demure and pathetic did they appear. Each, however, did not deny categorically the events you've heard, but rather blamed the other for the killing. Take Davy's account. Defending counsel Andrew Rumblow QC asked her during cross-examination if she'd ever been in trouble before she met her friend, to which she said she had been in trouble with the police, but only once, for shoplifting. "It was only once I stole a loaf of bread for a dare," she'd said. In tears, Davy then told Mr. Rumblow that it was her friend who had killed Mrs. Lily. On being asked if she intended Mrs. Lily to be killed, she replied firmly, "No." She went on to tell the jury of six men and six women that before meeting Healy in the first week of the summer holidays the previous year, she'd never before run away from home. But while with Healy, she ran away from home some six times, drank six or seven cans of beer a night, and smoked cannabis every day. It was during the last time they'd run away from home that it was alleged they had killed Mrs. Lily. Davy described, in part, during a cross-examination. "I went upstairs because I could hear nothing and I hadn't heard the toilet flush. As I got to the top of the stairs, I could see her holding Lily with a nighty thing around her face. She had a bandage around her mouth. I tried to pull her off Lily, and Lily gave me her purse, which I put up my sleeve. I thought they were fighting or something. Then Lily slapped her." There are elements of bollocks, even in court, from their stories, for Healy had told a similar tale in her statement to police, just with the roles reversed. She, however, had declined to give evidence in court. The jury saw both girls for the beasts that they were, and after deliberating for just 4 hours on Monday the 26th of July 1999, found both Healy and Davy guilty of the murder of Lily Lily, then dumping her body in a wheelie bin and abandoning it in a canal. Both girls wept uncontrollably when the verdict was given, and the hearing was then adjourned until the following day for the judge to consider lifting the ban on identifying the girls. The following day, again after a brief adjournment for both Healy and Davy to compose themselves because they'd broke down sobbing once again, presiding Mr. Justice Sachs, passing sentence, said, "You've both been convicted of an act of unbelievable cruelty. Two young girls, for totally pathetic reasons, destroyed a frail old lady in order to get her house. What you did was unspeakably wicked. You somehow got your victim upstairs to a bedroom, where a bandage was tied so tightly that it pushed her tongue backwards, displacing her dentures into her throat and obstructing her breathing. You've not shown the slightest trace of remorse or regret. You are both hard young women who've committed a terrible crime which almost defies belief by right-thinking people. Your only mitigation are your ages. You are both 15. He then sentenced both to be detained at Her Majesty's pleasure, effectively meaning a possible life sentence, as we've heard described before. Following the verdict, the officer who'd led the inquiry, Detective Superintendent Roy Rainford of Greater Manchester Police, told the Manchester Evening News that the jury had delivered a true and just verdict, adding, "These two girls quite calmly, coolly and cynically took over the house of an extremely vulnerable, pleasant, lonely old lady who welcomed in company, including children. Her reward for that was to have her property stolen and herself attacked and murdered. We don't know if they did it just for kicks. There's no rhyme nor reason to it. I have difficulty coming to terms with the manner in which two young girls carried out such a terrible offence on this vulnerable old lady. I find it incredible. I find it inconceivable that any person, especially two young girls, could commit such a wicked crime." I do too, as I'm sure that you folks do also. As I said, despite the judge at their trial lifting reporting restrictions following their conviction, both Healy and Davy were still known as Child A and B for several years afterwards, including up to when they appeared at the Court of Appeal in London on the 22nd of May 2001 in an attempt to overturn their convictions. Sitting together in court number 6 with an appropriate adult between them, one wearing a smart grey suit, the other a t-shirt with the words, "It wasn't me," across the front. They listened as the panel of appeal court judges, Lord Justice Kennedy, Mr. Justice Curtis and Mr. Justice Hughes, heard defence counsel Vera Baird QC claim that her client, Healy, had suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder caused by several attacks on her family by criminal gangs during her childhood. She told the panel that the reason she'd refused to give evidence during the trial was due to her mental state, and the jury should not have drawn any adverse inference from her silence. Lawyers for the pair had argued to the Court of Appeal that the facts of the case were more consistent with a robbery gone wrong than with any intent to kill or cause serious bodily harm, and that the girl should have been dealt with on the basis of diminished responsibility. However, it emerged here that 2 weeks before the two girls had murdered Lily, there were allegations they'd attacked another man, one in his 50s, some streets away in Failsworth, and the claims were identical in both cases, that the girls then took over the houses of both the man and Mrs. Lily. They'd also thrown out all of the man's clothes, another action they repeated after they'd killed Lily and took over her home. One resident, close to the man's flat, had said the girls had claimed that they'd been attacked by the man and he'd run away, so they'd taken over his flat. But the man, who remained unnamed, had told police and neighbours that he had to flee the flat after the two girls had attacked him with an axe and had stolen his credit cards. Though both girls were arrested and interviewed about this alleged attack on the man, no charges were brought, as he later withdrew his complaint and refused to cooperate with police. What possible reason would you have for dropping a complaint against minors who've attacked you with an axe, I wonder? The mind boggles. But it doesn't boggle at showing precedent of the actions of this pair. Although both of the appeals against conviction were dismissed, so you better change that bloody t-shirt, love, because it fucking was you, the judges still maintained this order banning the media from naming both girls, in this instance pending an impossible move to take the case to the House of Lords. It was November 2002 before the pair were publicly named for the first time, when Davy, then aged 18, and Healy, then aged 19, appeared once again at the Court of Appeal in London, this time to hear, at the time, England's most senior judge, Lord Chief Justice Wolfe, set the minimum tariff they would have to serve in prison. Speaking at the hearing, Lord Wolfe said he'd considered both prison and psychiatric reports and legal arguments on behalf of both girls, and remarked that although Healy had failed a drugs test whilst in custody, she was viewed by prison staff as being both polite and quiet and had expressed remorse for what she'd done. Lord Wolfe added that Davies' behaviour in custody, however, was described as mixed, including a reported suicide attempt, and that she only had, I quote, a limited understanding or acceptance of the gravity of the offence. The minimum tariff he then set for both girls to serve for the killing, committed in September 1998, was a minimum of 8 years. Yes, 8 years. It seems a bloody mockery, really, doesn't it? Another tragic aspect to this tale emerged in early 2009, whilst both Healy and Davy were still incarcerated, in that Lily's grave in Failsworth Cemetery still lay unmarked 11 years after her death. Though Lily had been buried alongside her husband Jack, no markings had been added to the headstone to recognise this. Her son John had reportedly attempted to obtain compensation money to get the stone engraved at the time of her funeral, but had been unsuccessful in raising the £227 quote to lift up the subsiding headstone and to clean and engrave it. A childhood friend of John's, who had helped police track him down to break news of the murder to him, had in his possession a letter from John that he'd left, giving him permission to seek funds to get the work done in his absence. The friend, who didn't want to be named and who had since lost touch with John, told the Oldham Chronicle newspaper, "The family would normally deal with it, but it was only John, and he wasn't in good health. It seems disgusting that all this money has been spent on the murderer, yet no one could be bothered to come up with a few £100 for the victim. Everyone says it's terrible, and then walks away and forgets about it." After this appeal, several offers were made to the family friend, but he had at the time failed to keep note of most of them, and reportedly couldn't continue when the one he'd chosen fell through. 4 years later, in April 2013, the same friend made another appeal through the Chronicle after a visit to the cemetery had prompted him to try once again. He said at the time, "Lily's grave is just the same. It really is a shame that it's been left like that. Last time there were offers from stonemasons to do the work for free, and I'm sure someone will be willing to do it this time." By August 2013, however, this had been rectified thanks to the generosity of a group of local residents who again wished to remain anonymous, but who had fundraised to obtain funds to have the plot made over, and sure stonemason Christian Haig, who had offered his £400 services to clean and engrave the stone for free. One chink of light in this terrible tale. Now, when the family friend had spoken in 2009, saying of being disgusted at, I quote, "It seems disgusting that all this money has been spent on the murderer," this stemmed from reports from the same year that Healy was being prepared for release and a new identity was being arranged at taxpayers' expense for both her and the baby she was at the time expecting. By 10 years into her sentence, she was a serving prisoner at HMP Ascombe Grange in York, an open prison which allows inmates nearing the end of their sentences day release in an attempt to reintegrate into the community, and had become pregnant after meeting Doncaster prisoner Michael Dent there in February 2008. Former public schoolboy Dent was at the time serving a 4-year sentence at Moorland Open Prison in Doncaster for running a cannabis factory at his Southampton home, and had been invited to Ascombe Grange as a prison representative on a Service User Forum Ministry of Justice seminar on prison reform there. Dent later told the Daily Mail newspaper, "A lot of the women inmates were training in hospitality ready for their release, so they would usher us around and serve tea and coffee. During one of the breaks, all 6 of us prisoners who were there as reps went outside for a cigarette and a mingle with the women. It was a real thrill after being locked up for a couple of years." Lisa had this glow about her. "At one point, we went for a long walk in the grounds of the prison and got to know each other better, as it were." Once the forum was over, The pair kept in touch and continued to see each other, with Healy driving from his jail to York to see her. Dent continued, I had a special license which allowed me to leave the prison for 18 hours at a time and spend the night away. Lisa was also entitled to town visits and could spend the day with me, but would have to return for the night. I was able to drive up there, pick her up, and take her away. It became a standing joke at Askham Grange. Healy fell pregnant following one such tryst at the 2-star Ibis Hotel in York, with Dent saying that when they first found out about the pregnancy, Healy feared that it could extend her jail term. He said, Lisa was panicking about her parole when she found out. Once she realised it would not be adversely affected by the pregnancy, she relaxed. A prison service spokesperson at the time denied the claim that the pair had been allowed to walk the grounds on their own, insisting that everyone was closely supervised throughout. I'm sure, yes. But they had confirmed the relationship between the two and insisted, somewhat defensively, that the pair had done nothing wrong by meeting on day release, also adding that it was not a breach of rules for a prisoner at an open jail to get pregnant. Following her giving birth to their daughter in April 2009, the relationship between Healy and Dent ended, and Healy stayed in a prison mother and baby unit for the remainder of her time at Askham Grange, before she was released on licence later that year. It was before this, however, that reports emerged that taxpayers faced footing the bill to provide killer Healy and her child with new identities when she was released on licence, even though she was moving back to the area she was from, moving back in with her parents, who lived less than 2 miles from the house in the Manchester area they'd occupied when she was convicted. It was believed that social services were behind the move, engineered so that Healy's daughter could grow up without the shackles of the infamy surrounding her mother's name. One Failsworth resident, who didn't wish to be named, said, It's a crazy situation. They must be spending a fortune on this plan, which won't protect her at all, because everyone in the area will know who she is. Her parents are very well known around there, so it will be no secret. She's already spent lots of time at her parents' house during her home releases from her open jail. A distant relative of Lily's, Ken Bell, also spoke angrily about the decision, saying, Why should the people of Britain have to pay for a change of identity for this murderer? Yet still the social workers want to spend a fortune to give the killer a new identity, even though it will serve no purpose whatsoever. Lisa Healy, as she was known, is today released from prison and living under a new identity at an undisclosed location. Right or wrong? Askham Grange was also where Davy ended up, transferred there from Drake Hall Prison in Staffordshire in 2012, as a reward for good behaviour. Drake Hall already sounds like a holiday camp enough. Inmates there reportedly share small houses instead of occupying cells, each with their own room for which they have a key. The prison also has hair and beauty salon facilities where training is available. Davy was one who had passed the hairdressing qualification there. There are lawns and benches where inmates can relax in the nice weather, while at night they're able to socialise in each other's rooms watching television and DVDs. Askham Grange was an even more relaxed regime than this for her too. When she'd arrived there, it shortly afterwards caused uproar when the Manchester Evening News revealed that prison bosses had granted her leave from the open jail for trips to Blackpool, hush-hush shopping trips to York, and had even landed her a job flogging second-hand gear to OAPs at a York charity shop. A source at the jail said, If only those women knew the horrifying truth behind the woman serving them. Indeed, eh? This is a woman who other inmates dubbed Scary Sarah, and who was said to, by 13 years into her sentence, revel in her notoriety as one of the longest serving female prisoners. The insider continued, Life is good here for Davy. She's in a very cushy prison, and is now starting to be allowed out for weekends away and shopping trips. That is despite the fact that she's serving an indefinite life sentence, though she's been told that she could be up for parole next year. When you think what she did to that poor woman, it's shocking to think that she's able to enjoy herself like that. It was also reported that Davy was at the time every bit as careful about her appearance as her counterparts in the outside world, and was given incredible leeway to try to look her best by prison authorities, including allowed monthly hair colourings to stop her roots showing, whilst also having her nails done fortnightly. In the summertime, Davy was able to soak up the sun's rays in the prison grounds, while the previous winter, she was reportedly even allowed out to visit tanning salons to maintain her colour. A former prison inmate told the Manchester Evening News, "She's so vain, she was always looking at herself in the mirror and she wouldn't come out of her room unless her makeup was perfect. It's full of toiletries and nice clothes she's been sent, so she can always look her best. People think she's in there for punishment, but she's enjoying herself. She's basically being treated like a pampered teenager." Davy's former fellow inmate then added, "Sarah's never shown any interest in men, but she did say maybe she should try and get pregnant like Lisa did, so she can be released sooner." Couldn't make it up, could you? Back in Failsworth, former neighbours of Lily reacted furiously when they learned of her killer's lifestyle in prison. Her former neighbour, Linda Tagger, said, "Having manicures and going on sunbeds isn't a punishment, that's like a holiday. I think it's absolutely despicable how she's treated. If that's what prison's like, I wouldn't mind going. Why should she get such special treatment? What happened to justice? Lily's not been given any. Lily was just a poor old lady who had lived on her own for a long time. She didn't harm anyone and deserved a bit of dignity in her old age. Those girls robbed her of that, and they should be properly punished, not be made up like a model. I don't think it's right Sarah should get all these treatments. Where's the punishment? I don't think she should be released on parole." Regardless of what people thought, parole indeed loomed up for Davy, and in October 2012, it was reported that she'd been given a weekly work placement at a travel lodge in York city centre to help her get used to living back in the community, just months ahead of a parole hearing at Ascombe Grange. But within months of her starting there, cash began to disappear, leading to Davy being arrested on suspicion of burglary. A prison source said at the time, "Sarah had been on a lot of town visits and started work, but she hasn't changed. She was working in the travel lodge in York city centre, and obviously none of the guests had a clue their chambermaid was a murderer. While in Ascombe Grange, she met her lesbian lover and they planned to set up home on the outside, but her arrest will now put a major spanner in the works. The parole board won't take it lightly. Lifers must not put a foot wrong." But even though she was reportedly transferred to Newhall Closed Prison near Wakefield in West Yorkshire, and had all of her release privileges taken away indefinitely following her arrest, no charges were brought against her, and it ultimately did not affect her possibility of parole, for in May 2013, Davy was released from prison on licence and allocated to live in a flat in Crumpsall, just a couple of miles from the murder scene. Again, the Failsworth community hit out at such a decision, with then Blackley and Broughton MP, Graham Stringer, whose constituency covered the Crumpsall area, telling the Manchester Evening News, "It seems to me to be very insensitive to allow her to live so close to where she committed such a notorious crime and where she may be able to come into contact with family, friends and neighbours of the victim. She shouldn't have been allowed to live in Greater Manchester, let alone just a few miles away. I think it's appalling." Neighbours and friends of Mrs. Lily also hit out. One West Street resident, who didn't want to be named, said at the time, "It's not right that she's living so close. Most people you hear of who commit crimes like that are moved to completely opposite ends of the country to allow everyone to move on. That should have happened here. I think as a community we've moved on because we have to, but for everyone who was involved at the time, we need a clean slate and not to be worried about seeing her again and all those emotions being brought back up. Another former neighbour of Lily's added, "If it was my daughter, I don't think I'd let her come back to the community. I don't think it does anyone any good." Davy's family indeed did live at the time, still just yards from the murder scene, which I was surprised at, to be honest, because I would have thought association with a crime so abhorrent would lead to so much shame that a fresh start somewhere else would surely have been the very best thing for all. Officials from the Ministry of Justice subsequently defended their decision allowing Davy to move back into the area. They gave the usual waffle about all offenders released on parole being on strict licence, subject to recall at any time, blah blah blah, you know. But emphasised that though when offenders are released on licence, the ministry has the power to exclude the individual from certain areas to protect the victim's family, and restrictions can be placed on where offenders live to protect victims and their families. It did not affect this case, because Mrs. Lily's only son, John, lived in Australia with her three grandchildren, and she was not thought to have any other living family in the area, thus negating the need for said restrictions. Davy lasted just 6 months before she came to police attention once again, this time in November 2013, when the then 29-year-old was arrested for a breach of the peace one evening, after drunkenly pounding on the windows and doors of a house in Failsworth's Old Road, just a quarter of a mile from the scene of a horrific crime 15 years before. However, she was released without charge, and probation bosses decided that the incident was not serious enough to have her recalled to prison. She moved to a bail hostel in the Liverpool area following this, and just 2 weeks later, in December 2013, the MEN reported that the notorious killer was back behind bars, recalled to prison due to a breach of the terms of her life licence after cocaine was found in her system during a routine drugs test. A Greater Manchester Probation Trust spokesperson said at the time, "Life licence offenders are subject to a strict set of conditions and controls, including restrictions on their movements and employment, as well as frequent meetings with their offender manager. If they fail to comply with their licence conditions, they are liable to be returned to custody." However long she served due to this before being released once again isn't reported, though research for the episode suggests that today, Sarah Davy, who hasn't changed her name at all, as her Facebook profile would suggest, is once again out on licence, still in the Manchester area, and today also, even having at least one child of her own, a daughter. Part of the blurb on the available Facebook profile page of Davy, above just how much she loves her daughter, reads, "What goes around comes around." Now I don't know whether this is an epiphany, a sincere wish, something placed in that sounds enigmatic or is meant to make her appear intelligent, whatever. I thought it a strange thing to add in the circumstances. All I could say is, I would have thought she would hope against hope that what goes around doesn't come around in her case, and of course, that Davy's daughter grows up to be nothing like her mother was, or perhaps even still is. Where do you even start with such a horrendously sad tale? It's a sad fact that there are people like Lily to be found almost everywhere that you go. Figures who are recognisable for their appearance or their eccentricities, and who are wrongfully targeted because of these as figures of fun to so many, yet who may be perfectly happy and content in whatever world they make for themselves. That shouldn't automatically make them a target or a victim though, and I think I found Lily's tale especially sad because things such as this, they just shouldn't happen, should they? For all of the neighbours gushing about what a harmless old lady she was and how she was well liked, etc., etc., nobody really seemed to care for her, did they? Even her own son, though I may be being somewhat harsh there. But the impression I was left with, even from him, was that Lily was one of these out of sight, out of mind people, and nobody should be like that. I found Lily an especially tragic victim who had seemingly led a life of struggling, of early loss and loneliness, only to have the final indignity of being murdered in such a callous and, what must have been, terrifying way for her. And then to just be dumped in a wheelie bin, no less, considered no more than a mere piece of rubbish. I found it abhorrent and heartbreaking. Poor, poor lady. As for Davy and Healy, there are plenty of words I could use to describe them, mostly unbroadcastable ones, really. But the word that sums up the pair for me, monsters, pure monsters, it's one of the most callous tales I've ever come across. And I'm sure you can see why I selected it for this series, Monsters Of. For two girls so young at the time to commit something of this magnitude and the behaviour they displayed afterwards, what other word do you use, I ask you? I thought that the tariffs set for both were just deplorable, a slap in the face to Lily, and I do hope that at some point whilst they've been incarcerated, Healy, Davy, or both of them had the absolute living fuck kicked out of them. Hopefully more than once too. For this is certainly a case that prison justice needed to be served in this one is, if ever there was one. I understand completely also the anger felt by residents of the area when news of Davy's cushy life in prison or Healy's new identity had filtered out. For as I said before, it's a slap in the face that. Even more of a mockery of Lily's senseless death. I was already left with a haunting and sad impression that in life she wasn't someone who mattered very much to anybody, as well as even in death, which was evidenced with the whole bloody headstone debacle I described. So to see the punishment that her killers get, yeah, I'd be annoyed too. Any decent people would and should be. It seemed scant punishment for a crime I consider to be one that was wicked beyond belief. And I ask you, do you think that someone responsible for such horror ever fully loses that level of wickedness that they can sink to? Myself, I'm not sure if people like that can. But I ask you not to remember Dave or Healy first and foremost from this tale. Give those parasites less than a second thought going on. But instead, remember Lily. She's certainly someone I've never forgotten going forward from this tale, and I hope hers is a name that now you won't either. I would love, as always, to hear your thoughts and feedback on the tale I've brought you in the episode Monsters of Greater Manchester, which you can do so in the episode thread that's now up in the show's Facebook discussion group, or if you wish to discuss, then you can through any of the show's social media links. I'm not hard to find at all. With that, it's wrap-up time here, and time to delve back into the annals for another tale. As I said at the start, look out for perhaps more than one tale upcoming of just how cruel some individuals can be. With that, I thank you very much for joining myself and the Hairy Football here today, and all that remains for me to say is that I've been, I still am, and hopefully still will be Paul, the true crime enthusiast, wishing you all good and safe times, and I shall speak to you very soon. Take care all, stay safe, and goodbye for now.